Hey, before we get going, I want to bring you a quick word from our sponsor this week, Xdat. They are at xdat.io. They're a European crypto exchange. They're launching something new called the Bullwhip Movement. You can earn incentives of up to 2,000 euros in their native token. So here's how you do it. You go to xdat.io and register yourself, whitelist yourself to save a spot, and add at least 5 users who actively trade. Once they've traded 1,000 euros, you will have fully earned your community token on your node. So whitelist a node today. The first 200 nodes that sign up will earn extra benefits. Again, xdat.io. I'll put some links in the show description. Thanks to them for sponsoring this week's show. Let's do it. Hello and welcome to Coin Talk, the show of Bitcoin crashes. I'm Aaron Lammer. My co-host, Jay Kang, is on other assignment this week, but I have a worthy successor in the crypto cave. It's Marty Bent. He runs the Tales from the Crypt podcast. You've probably heard about him on the show because I like read his newsletter and respond to it in real time on the show sometimes. We'll have him on in a second. We're brought to you by Medium. Medium has so much great writing about crypto that you really ought to become a member. It's $5 a month. It supports writers. It supports things like this show. Let's do the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, April 10th at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $5,243.
Marty, hello.
Aaron, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be in this cave. This is a very, very cool studio.
Did you know that there was a secret Bitcoin cave in your own neighborhood?
I did, but not until like 3 or 4 weeks ago when we got lunch and you told me about it. I'm very happy to finally be here.
So you run a crypto podcast, which everyone should go out and listen to. Like I would say, if this is the least knowledgeable Bitcoin podcast, I think yours is the most knowledgeable one that I listen to.
We try. I don't know about most knowledgeable. Maybe just like been through this shit for too long.
I appreciate also like, so you do the show with Matt O'Dell and he's like kind of the like crazy one and you're kind of the reasonable one. Is that a, is that a fair assessment of your dynamic?
Crazy. Matt is a cypherpunk. He's like a crazy privacy focused individualist, I would say.
Well, I'm enjoying this opportunity because I feel like if I were to place you and Matt and me and my co-host Jay on a spectrum, like Jay's more skeptical than me and I'm more skeptical than you. So I'm actually going to be the reasonable one in this, in just in this pairing.
Right. No, like it's crazy to think that I'm tame next to Matt when I don't think I'm tame at all when it comes to this stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Like, I feel like this comes up the most often when people talk about like keeping private keys, you know, where it's like we've been talking recently about these Quadriga exchange hacks. And there's like a certain kind of a Bitcoin person who's like, suckers, you kept your coins on exchanges? Come on, guys. And you're like, okay. I won't keep my coins on exchange. Like, I'll put it on this wallet. And then someone reads like something like your newsletter and it's like frequently about how you could like hack hardware wallets. I'm like, ah, fuck. There's always like one level more paranoid to take your Bitcoin activities.
Right. If anything, Bitcoin has made me way more paranoid than I was when I was a young teenager before I had been introduced to Bitcoin. And no, it's a crazy spectrum, right? And I think the thought process through which one has to approach Bitcoin is a lot different than what a lot of people are used to in the incumbent financial system. So number one, what I talk a lot about in the newsletter and on Tales from the Crypt is that Bitcoin as a bearer asset, as a digital bearer asset, is sort of a new beast for humanity. So the sort of ways in which you interact with that asset and more importantly, custody it are, they vary. Different risks come with different sort of levels of the custody that you decide to engage with.
I often wonder if like some of the people I know who are more resistant to crypto, who I actually think would enjoy it or find it interesting. Like I know some people, you're younger than me. I feel like I'm like on the, an old to some people and a young to other people. But like, I know a lot of guys like Paul Ford who were part of like the very first blogging generation. Mm-hmm. And some of those people have been like, come on, like, how can you not be interested in this? You know, like, you saw something come anew on the internet. Aren't you interested in this other new thing? And they're like, eh, I just don't want to dip myself into this paranoia and darkness, you
right.
know?
Well,
it's like some people, I think, rightfully are like, even though that's interesting, it's like not a direction I want to take my life. Like, I do not want to have to think about hiding some sort of a secret private key with instructions for my grandchildren after I die, you know?
Right. Well, that's the nature of what it is right now. And that's why all these risks are involved. Like, if you are willing to take the risk to self-custody and take this into your own hands, there's a chance that you will be rewarded in the long run. And I think like the UX around custody in particular is getting a lot better, specifically with multi-sig solutions that are coming to market and being open sourced. And then just overall enterprise level custody for institutional clients is getting better
yeah.
as well. And it will get better over time. So yeah, right now, like with the exchange stuff and Bitcoin's very checkered past for its first decade, I understand why people are apprehensive. And again, it's called risk for a reason. And going back to like old heads that get it, one that does is Adam Carey, the podcasting godfather. And he gets it because of his fascination with ham radio. And he realized like you can relay transactions via ham radio waves. And he actually did it like, I believe, a month or two ago with Rodolfo Novak from up in Montreal, I believe, or maybe Alberta, who runs like Cold Card and Open Dime, sent Adam Carey a Bitcoin transaction over radio wave.
I often get it, like I was talking to a pretty famous business writer actually this week about this topic. And I was trying to give him my like optimistic defense of Bitcoin. And I think I often like land on, like we've talked a lot about the Venezuela situation. And I think if you were to like be like, no, you can't give 19 reasons why Bitcoin is important, you can only give one. I would probably give the like, you don't really know where the world is going. Economies collapse all the time. Currencies collapse all the time. People are going to want a way to take their wealth with them across borders that's like safe from governments and whatever horrible things are coming in the next 100 years on this earth. And I think that's convincing of people, but he threw it back at me in a way that was interesting where he was like, yeah, I totally get that. Like, I can see why it's really important. But like, why would you want to hold Bitcoin in as an American then? Like, a lot of my reasoning about why Bitcoin is important is that there's almost like a privilege to like living in such a stable financial system. And it's like, yeah, like maybe we don't need Bitcoin here, but like there's all these people around the world who do. And then I had never really thought about, well, why should you hold it in America then? Like, why should you be the bleeding edge of that risk spear?
I don't know. Again, like Americans are very addicted to risk, just as a culture, as a society, as a capitalist nation. And I believe many Americans who have caught the Bitcoin bug see the potential for it. And again, America is a very well-educated country, so I think a lot of people, especially in the tech space, are able to see these trends pretty early on. And Bitcoin, if it is successful in its endeavors, the total addressable market that it could potentially consume, the amount of value that it consumes is astronomical compared to where it is now. So it's one of the largest asymmetric bets from a speculation standpoint that's existed in millennia, some people would argue. So the fact that Americans are participating in that doesn't surprise me. And then even with that being said, just because we don't necessarily need it now because we have the US dollar and it's the reserve currency of the world, doesn't mean Bitcoin isn't better or won't be a better product in the future. And getting exposure to that, I mean, again, it's risk, and if you're willing to take that risk, again, at this point, you will be rewarded. And
it's funny, as Americans,
not you will be rewarded; you could potentially be rewarded. This is yeah. not a foregone conclusion.
No, none of this is investment advice.
No,
I feel like as Americans, we're kind of addicted both to risk and to debt, mm-hmm. and they're like they're companions. They're like
sort of hand in hand.
Like we tell young people, hey, you should gamble that the value of your college loans will be like smaller than the increase in your wages that you get from it. And like, I remember I had a friend who's German and she was like, oh, I don't have any credit cards. I was like, oh yeah, but like, you know, like debit card or whatever. She's like, no, we don't have credit cards in Germany. And I was like shocked to find out that like Germans just don't use credit. There is no such thing as credit cards in Germany.
Aaron, I got my first credit card last year, And wow. I'm looking at my phone. I'm not answering a text. I'm looking for a chart that somebody shared with me today that charts wage inflation against college tuition. And it's abysmal. And that,
yeah, there's no way wages could keep up with college tuition in this country. The minimum wage would have to be $100 an hour for wages to catch up with how much college has cost in America.
Yeah, it's insane. And as somebody who, shit, I'm already 5 years out of college. I'm just like 5 years out of college. It's crazy to see how expensive college has become even since I left. And while I was there, it got considerably more expensive year over year. And it's sad to see because it's seeping down into the high school level too. Like, I was lucky enough to go to a private high school in Philly. I did do work study. It was like a quarter of my tuition. But when I was a freshman, tuition was like $8,000. By the time I was a senior, it was $12,000. And now it's $24,000. Like, this education racket is seeping down to every level. And it's not even really a strong argument against this. This is pretty much a fact. Like, the government giving out all these loans and enabling this credit expansion, and with student loans in particular, is the reason why these prices are going up. Like, colleges are saying, hey, the government's going to give out these loans willy-nilly to anybody who wants them. We're going to raise prices and see how much they'll pay for this. And it's part of the reason why I'm into Bitcoin is, I think, the control of money and the expansion of credit in particular has gotten out of control, and Bitcoin is sort of a return to sanity in the sense that you can't enable a misallocation of capital at the scale that has been enabled under this current monetary regime.
So for you, like, where were you in your life when crypto entered in your life? What were you doing?
So I was a senior in high school in the fall of 2008. I just so happened to be taking an economics elective when the world was going to shit. The teacher, Mr. Robson, shout out Mr. Robson, a bit creepy, but was really like into economics and really like, hey, you guys should be focusing on this. And yeah, Obviously shit was hitting the fan that year. You know, my dad was in finance, so he was affected a little bit. And so I went into college with a sort of know your enemy mindset to learn about economics. I was like, how the hell did it get this bad? Went to college at DePaul University in Chicago. And because I was in Chicago, I was afforded the ability to work at an internship early on, like while I was in ag class. So I was studying economics and working at a managed futures fund my junior and senior year. I'd been into Bitcoin, and part of that job at the managed futures fund, I was an analyst, and we were a fund of funds, and the funds that we invested in, a lot of them traded currencies. So part of my job was writing commentaries on why our fund performed the way it did against market movements, which meant I had to follow currency markets, which meant I had to follow central banks. And over the course of 3 years, I just realized they were setting goals, not hitting them, and they didn't really have a grasp on the implications of the policies they were implementing. And at that same time, I was learning about Bitcoin, and it all just sort of clicked for me. Like, this is, like, you cannot have 12 men in a room trying to micromanage a multi-trillion-dollar economy with interest rates. Like, it's probably not advantageous. Money as a tool should probably be apolitical and something that really can't be controlled by any one entity. And that's sort of what pushed me into Bitcoin.
We talk on this show, like, I call myself a crypto moderate. Mm-hmm. And to me, I wouldn't say that you're on the, like, full, like, Odell extreme there, but, like, some of the things that you're espousing are, they would be a pretty extreme 90-degree right turn for the American economy were it to move away from its current trajectory towards the trajectory you're describing. And it's probably just that I'm, like, in some ways become a conservative old man who's like, no, I think the world should stay as it is. But some of this stuff feels a little bit like the economic version of forming a militia and going trading in the woods, you know? And I understand, like, in some ways, the militia isn't really there to fight a war. It's sort of like a preparation, like, Boy Scouting exercise. And I think some of crypto culture, like, has, like, echoes of that. It's kind of not, we're starting a revolution tomorrow, but it's like, we're going to go start jogging together in matching suits so that we're, like, all, like, on the same page when it comes. But I guess my question would be, as, like, someone who has a lot of, like, a background in traditional finance, does that scare you at all? Does that idea of totally jumping off the bridge? Like, I totally agree that the existing system is flawed, but Also, I think I'm like historically sensitive to the idea that revolutions, we have to like kill a lot of people to have that revolution, you know? On the show, we've called it like the Bitcoin Caliphate before. Like, it has like a little bit like, you're with us or against us.
Death and if to
you're
the against no-coiners.
Them, we have guns. People are not going to like, whoever is in charge of that system isn't like willingly going to be like, sure, take the wheel, Bitcoiners.
No, I agree. And it is scary. And that's the thing. Is that the, like, again, my years at the Managed Futures Fund and studying in college, that's the scariest part for me is when you realize how the system works and how money works in particular, it's scary as shit because you realize that you have, again, 12 men in America in particular trying to micromanage an economy, more importantly, the pricing mechanism of that economy via interest rates and this creates a lot of subdued volatility over time. That's why we have huge booms and busts. And just looking at the overall trend of where we are over the last 100 years and then over the last 500 years, if you break it into super cycles, if you look at the Federal Reserve balance sheet, you can go to St. Louis Fred, search St. Louis Fred on Google, look up the monetary base over time. It doesn't go all the way back to 1913, but that's when the Fed's monetary base started. So from 1913 to 2008, a 95-year period, the Fed's monetary base, which represents the amount of money they've printed over time, expanded from zero to $800 billion. So 95 years, the Fed's balance sheet expanded $800 billion. Between 2008 and 2014, it went from $800 billion to $4.3 trillion. So you have a quintupling of what took 95 years to develop over the course of 6 years. So that alone, if you look at the chart, it just looks unnatural and unhealthy. So there's just like heuristics in my brain that go off like this is a weird experiment. Like it could probably go wrong if these people don't know what they're doing. And time is proving that they really don't know what they're doing. So in that situation, it's like, all right, we need a solution to this. Like money is fucked, I would say. And Bitcoin has presented that perfect roundabout way to not a perfect escape valve, but something that we can build in parallel and sort of start educating people about to get them more comfortable with.
Let me ask you a question there. This is great because normally I feel like some of these views we treat as like a sock puppet when we talk about them. And it's like, it's better like when someone actually believed them, mm-hmm. You know? I have an inherent bias that the world is run by people and by human nature. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that you're critical of the people who are currently in charge of the economy, not a surprise, right? Like, people running the economy going to catch some flack. And Bitcoin presents this no one's driving the ship view of economics. And I have to say, since I've said several negative things about Kwong, it's amazing that it's gotten this far. Mm-hmm. Like, the truly most miraculous thing of the entire crypto story is the Bitcoin chain is still alive and works and is more or less what was described in a academic paper more than 10 years ago. That's incredible. Like, mm-hmm. The odds are like 1 in a million that it was even going to get this far. But in a larger sense, like if Bitcoin moves towards the Bitcoin caliphate vision that we're describing, do you think that eventually people will start running Bitcoin? Like, do you think Bitcoin can really operate sort of without that human intervention creeping in and in some ways replacing one system that's 12 men in a room with 12 different men in a different room with a different currency?
Yeah, so I think this is where a lot of people get confused. It's like when we say Bitcoin as an economic system won't be changed, what people mean is like
me and the senior caliphate leadership.
Yeah, exactly. What I believe people mean by that is like there are certain rules within Bitcoin that are preset and are sort of defined and should probably stay in the protocol in perpetuity. Most importantly, the 21 million Bitcoin cap.
Sure.
And then people sort of take that and say, all right,
that'll be in the constitution of the caliphate. Yeah. It's a caliphate with a constitution.
That, but like people say, all right, the protocol is running and it's like running by itself and self-sufficient and there's no human intervention, that's exactly what you want. You just want to have certainty that you want it to act like basically a metronome. It's going to produce censorship-resistant distributed blocks of transactions roughly every 10 minutes. It's going to have a difficulty adjustment on the mining algorithm every 2016 blocks. It's going to have a halving every 210,000 blocks. And basically, you have certainty knowing that that protocol is going to do something at any given point in time. Or you can predict what it's going to do at any given point in time. On top of that protocol, like, you can anchor into that trust protocol. So that's the way I view Bitcoin. Like, you can build, if you like, if you're so willing, you can build financial products and something similar to the financial system that we have today. The only difference with Bitcoin is there is no, like, lender of last resort at the protocol level, at the base layer, to sort of print more units to inflate the currency. You can create
a, it's a PC, but does not come with a printer.
Exactly. But you can create, if you're willing to take the risk to loan out money and create similar financial products like we have today, you can certainly do that. You just have to have a bit more certainty that you'll get reimbursed for your loan or something like that.
You can print more Tether to try to get the Bitcoin, but you can't print any more Bitcoin.
Exactly. And basically what Bitcoin enables is we're still going to be able to take risks. We're still going to be able to have credit markets and stuff. It's just like, if you're loaning out Bitcoin to bad creditors and they go bust, like, you just have to eat that. There's no lender of last resort to come and save you. So you try to cut the fat as soon as possible, and hopefully people are making wiser investment decisions. Like, that's a lot of the flack that the Fed gets, is in the way they print money, is that they create, like, an inherent misallocation of capital, because they're skewing the pricing mechanism of the globe. And basically, by printing money, you're enabling people to invest in things that probably otherwise wouldn't be invested in. You're sort of, again, a misallocation of capital. It just forces people to think more intently about what they're going to invest in, how they're going to spread their risk out.
I just find that the Bitcoin culture has succeeded in, like, creating high-minded rhetoric and low-minded people. Like, the founder of the religion is not the person who spreads the religion. It's like, you know, it's the, like, Roger Vares of the world who spread the religion. You know, like, I was just seeing that, like, Justin Sun is still around from Tron. I think he, like, gave away
a
couple
Teslas or something like that.
We got to talk about this, actually. Pause on the larger discussion. But so he was giving away a Tesla, I think. And then someone was, like, looked into the code, which had produced the winner, and was like, this Tesla giveaway was rigged.
Yeah.
And he was like, shit, we'll do it again. And the first guy was like, what the fuck? I want a Tesla. He was like, okay, we'll give away two Teslas.
Well, yeah, it seemed like, because he did another thing, another similar campaign before that, where he, like, promised followers who retweeted him some money too. I think a considerable amount. It seems like he's just trying to buy followers.
Well, we've used the term, we use the blanket term on the show, Super Airdrop Festival. So Super Airdrop Festival is whenever you're giving anything away to try to get basically new monthly active users.
Right.
Like, this is what all the exchanges do.
Tron bought BitTorrent,
which is a real thing and worked. Like, yeah. If someone had just made BitTorrent in crypto, it would be far and away the most useful app ever created.
BitTorrent's the perfect example of having a distributed system that doesn't need a blockchain.
And BitTorrent is also an incredible example of protocol cooperation across disparate entities with competing goals, all to use a single system that doesn't, I think I would say torrents are censorship proof in basically the same way as unless you somehow can shut down enough spokes on it, like, mm-hmm. I guess you can keep people from uploading in a country, but I don't think you can really shut down a torrent.
Yeah, and there's actually John Backus, I might be butchering his name, he's in San Francisco, I'm not sure where he works or what he does, but he wrote a very interesting piece on the distributed file sharing systems, like, in the late 90s, early 2000s, and how BitTorrent actually won out, like, against like the Napsters, LimeWires,
Nutellas
of the world.
Yeah.
And it was basically because they were very vague in their UX and kept themselves sort of below the radar.
Well, it was always unclear what the relationship between the company BitTorrent and the protocol torrenting.
Mm-hmm.
I got into it because my dad was a deadhead.
Okay.
And so my dad, like, the deadheads were, like, the first people who were, like, moving weight on BitTorrent because they were trying to do lossless full concerts, and like, you know, if you have one Grateful Dead concert, you have 1,000 Grateful Dead concerts. It's like serious amount of data, you know. And this was like late 90s even, I think, or maybe early aughts, I guess. Yeah, no, maybe even late 90s. I don't even remember when BitTorrent came out, but so he was into it. And then I was like, so like, what else can you like get on this? And it's kind of an amazing system in that, you know, everyone's like, Bitcoin is so hard. We need to educate people. You know, you got Brian Armstrong being like, I'll give you $50 in Stellar Lumens to learn about Stellar Lumens, which is basically like, come to my re-education camp. You'll be paid you'll get an Amazon gift card on the last day. I never got like an instruction manual for BitTorrent. You download the BitTorrent software, you click on a torrent and it starts downloading. And it actually like teaches you how it works pretty well. It's like, how many seeds are you connected to? Okay, well, if everyone just leeches, no one seeds, game over. All of the dynamics that are at play in Bitcoin mining and hash are basically present in a private torrent tracker where they measure how much you download and upload and you're expected to maintain a ratio. Mm-hmm. The only part that's different is it's like a bunch of Chinese factories that are maintaining the ratio and we're just like buying their work, but...
China just banned Bitcoin.
I saw that. So how do you read something like that? I'm curious. Like, because I'll get a few texts, even though I don't actually really know that much about crypto. People are like, so China banned Bitcoin mining? And I'm like, no, that's fake. Well, it's not fake. It's a crypto story.
Yeah. Yeah. China's banned Bitcoin so many times. It's like the boy who cried wolf at this time. And it's not that big of news, in my opinion, because a lot of the Chinese miners who got freaked out during the last wave of Chinese bans have moved over to other borders. And there's actually a lot of people starting operations here in the U.S. too. So it's actually good.
Yeah, I mean, green energy mining feels like it's the future, and that probably is not going to coincide with Chinese mining being the future.
No, Chinese mining is clean too. 77, well, there's a lot of coal mining in China, but a lot of it is...
Other than all the coal mining, it's very clean.
There is a lot of dirty mining in China. There's also a lot of the untapped hydroelectric, and that it's like another... So you're saying like certain ways of framing Bitcoin a little bit earlier. That's another topic that's been I've been talking about with some people more recently. Like, what if Satoshi pitched Bitcoin as a synthetic battery instead of like a monetary system before? Because I believe that Bitcoin presents an immense opportunity to become as energy efficient as possible as we can on this planet. And that's because Bitcoin mining finally provides an incentive to go tap these previously untapped resources, which, as CoinShare showed, 77% tend to be renewable energy, mostly hydroelectric and geothermal and wind. Even if they're off by like an order of magnitude, let's say it's 38% renewable, like the average quote unquote industry in the world is only using like 18% renewables. So, and the reason for this is because they're just cheap, like nobody can use them. And the problem with these renewable energies in particular is that they're stranded in disparate areas where there's no cities, there's no industry, there's nothing. So there's
places in Texas where they'll actually pay you to take power off the grid.
Yes, exactly. And Texas is a great example of Texas is, I believe, the only state that has like a completely free market on their grid. Like you're allowed to do whatever you want and the market's figuring out. It's not like run by the state. So I know there's a lot of wind farms in Texas that are looking to offload some capacity. And again, the thing about the renewable energies is they're so cheap. So that it's like the incentive for these miners is to go find them so that they have the biggest margin possible when they're mining Bitcoin. So if you can go, I believe to be competitive right now, you have to have between 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. A lot of these renewable sources, again, they're untapped. And if it's a wind farm in Texas and they're not able to sell it, they sell it for half a cent a kilowatt hour, you're beating the market by 6x in pricing there. So
yeah, I mean, it feels like the market for electricity is basically trying to find its sub 1 cent product, mm-hmm. You know, in the same way that like we had like cell phones for a long time, but they were like $500 a month when they came out. And it was like, okay, there's some sort of like a tipping point here where people are going to like search out this cheap electricity. And I was talking to my friend Francis, who's a musician, about this because he's really interested in self-driving cars. And we were like talking it through like at some point, self-driving cars will be like their own businesses, right? Like mm-hmm. the cars will just drive around looking for you, and they will need to be like operating as weird, almost like smart contract small businesses or fleets that are trading with each other. They're going to have to stop and refuel energy. And it basically makes sense that the unit of money or exchange that they will be using is electricity, right? That's their native token already is electricity. And in some ways, like when someone will say, oh, the price of, you know, Bitcoin costs $2,000 to mine, I'm like, no, it seems to me like a Bitcoin costs $5,200 to mine. I haven't looked at my portfolio today. $5,200-ish dollars to mine, because that's how much Bitcoin costs. Like Bitcoin, the value of Bitcoin is basically an electrical unit on some level.
Again, like going back to the synthetic battery, not everybody's cost for mining a Bitcoin is $5,200 right now. Like it's disparate, right?
Right, right. I just mean that if the price of Bitcoin is $5,200 and you are trading it for electricity, right? If you're like, I give you a Bitcoin, how much power will you give me back? You'll give me $5,200-ish dollars worth of power, mm-hmm. you know? So to a car, there's no distinction in all of these like electrical fiat Bitcoin transactions. They're just X, you know? I guess it's the Bitcoin caliphate. It's one Bitcoin is worth one Bitcoin.
One Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. You're describing the machine payable web that 21Co had in mind when they came out with their small, very underpowered miner.
I think that you've actually just brought the conversation. You've like done a callback, because didn't 21Co become earn.com and then get acquired by Coinbase and then open the Stellar Lumens re-education camp?
We just came full circle, yes. Yeah. 21Co turned into an email company, which eventually got bought by Coinbase, which is now trying to push shitcoins on people.
Yeah. I mean, like, why do people try all this crap? I guess would be the question. Or, like, why couldn't they figure out how to make money mining? Feels to me like everyone in crypto starts off being like, I'm going to get rich. And then they're like, oh, and this and that and some other scheme. Like, is mining even like a good business, do you think, in the long run?
That's a good question.
It shouldn't be, no. Right?
So with 21Co in particular, like earlier Bitcoin, there was like this transition from CPUs to GPUs to FPGAs to ASICs. And I think a lot of people made a lot of assumptions around mining that turned out not to be as smart in the long run. 21Co very much made like bad decisions. Like I bought a 21Co. It'll one day.
Like you made the bad decision.
Yeah, I made a bad decision. It was actually good to learn like how to interact with the blockchain via the command line, but it was a terrible miner.
Where were you running this miner?
Just in my apartment.
Get like
it's like this big. It was on a Raspberry Pi. Like you were the pitch was that you would mine. So again, went back to the machine payable web. You would mine at a very low hash rate into the 21Co pool, and you get Satoshis back for contributing to the pool, which would enable an app that you would use in the 21Co app space, which would be like a machine payable web sort of setup. But that never came to fruition because the miners were way too underpowered, and it just didn't make any sense. I don't think it was profitable at all.
Yeah. Smartest guys in the room. Smart.
Well, that's the other thing. Like that Coinbase consolidation. Coinbase is basically a16z's portfolio consolidation company in the crypto space. I just think, again, going back to monetary economics, I think a lot of people, especially in Silicon Valley and San Francisco, approach quote unquote crypto and Bitcoin in a naive way. And I do think you have to take sort of monetary economics into play with this stuff, and a lot of the move fast and break thing mentality that exists in Silicon Valley has pushed some of these VCs and companies to test out things that probably weren't wise to test out.
Well, one thing I learned from this era, I was interested in like Silicon Valley before I was interested in Bitcoin. And the main thing I've like picked up from every single VC's actions within Bitcoin is Bitcoin winning is not going to be a big winner for investors. Anything like there's a bunch of other like directions it could go. If Stellar Lumens becomes huge, then that's good for like the earn.com acquisition payout to Coinbase. But at some point, I'm not saying there was like a secret cabal meeting to decide this. People were like, so if Bitcoin just keeps getting bigger and bigger and nothing else happens, we don't benefit that much,
right,
even though that's what we do.
Right.
Like, why was it so hard for them to succeed alongside Bitcoin instead of tugging the ship the other direction?
It's just a product of the environment, which they're going to just spray and pray, like invest in as many things as possible. And in this space, they extrapolate that to invest in as many protocols as possible. And in the startup realm, it's not winner takes all. It's not zero sum.
Yeah.
You let a thousand blooms. But again, coming back to monetary economics, Bitcoin is a sly roundabout way to take the money out of the hands of the government. So Friedrich Hayek said, we'll never get money fixed until we take it. If we find a sly roundabout way to take it from the government. I believe Bitcoin is that. And once you have, and basically what that means is now that there's a free market for competing currencies that hasn't existed in a while. And now that that optionality exists, previously your power laws aren't going to take over. Individual governments are going to have their own currencies, and there's international law to protect that. Now that Bitcoin exists, there's a free market for this. The sort of law that Bitcoiners believe in will take place over time is Thiers' law, which is the opposite of Gresham's law, which says good money drives out bad. And Bitcoiners believe that Bitcoin in this crypto space has the best chance to be the best money, and it'll be sort of a zero-sum game in the long run. Obviously, there's a lot of shitcoin pumps still going on. I believe they will persist for a while, but in the long run, most of the value will accrue to Bitcoin. And what we've seen over the first decade is a lot of would-be upstarts coming and sort of failing over time and new iterations of them. So first it was like Namecoin, Peercoin, your first POS coins, like early in the 2013 Scambrian explosion. And then it iterated to ICOs.
Pour one out for the dead alts.
Pour one out for the dead alts. But what we found over the last 10 years is that Bitcoin will stay at number one, and in the bottom 10 or 20 below them will just churn, or 2,000 below them will just churn. I think that's a product of the market sort of testing out new ideas and quickly realizing Bitcoin may be the only game in town.
Well, when I look back at the history of protocols, right, what are the three most important protocols of our time? I would say email is the number one most important protocol. Number two is probably HTML, and distant third, but like one of the most important in my own life is torrenting, right? And when you look at those three inventions, particularly email, never really made any startups or IPOs a lot of money. Like, has anyone gotten rich on email particularly? It's facilitated the growth of the digital economy. So you could say it's created trillions of dollars of value, HTML too, particularly, but no one's really made money on email or HTML. It's almost like they had to invent a bunch of side pots to cash in on those trends. And once you sort of categorize Bitcoin as similar to email, it looks really like different from an investment perspective, at least for people who are like funding companies. Like, it's almost like, hey, don't expect that like Bitcoin or blockchains or anything is actually going to make a lot of money for someone. Email didn't. It's free. Hotmail's free. You know, like we had free email was one of like the first things that was offered for free, right, ever.
AOL had a quick run.
So we'll see a few spikes. Mm-hmm. CompuServe, right. AOL, Prodigy.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those companies have real lasting value because they don't own email. Right. So taking that a step further, does Bitcoin almost recede into the background as it becomes more prevalent, do you think?
Yeah, that's one theory, is that it'll sort of have this UI built on top of it as the layers get built on top of it as well, and it'll sort of be pushed to the background where you don't even know you're using it in most of the ways that you interact with it. I don't know, though. Again, going back to that, this is a bearer instrument. This is like a different animal than anything, at least in a digital realm, that is literally the first digitally scarce asset that's ever existed. So the ways in which we interact with it, I don't know. Like I got breakfast this morning. I can just see like so many paths which we go down. And again, I just, cling on to the fact that this is a different type of asset that we're still trying to figure out how to grasp and how to handle. But I could definitely see in the future, as the UX and the protocol gets built out, that yes, it could be pushed to the background. You don't even notice you're using it. Like in apps like Cash App, like there it is.
Just gonna ask about that.
Yeah, like Cash App could, if they build out their product suite and their functionalities around Bitcoin, you could just Cash App is a quasi second layer to Bitcoin. If they can facilitate everything within their servers, if that's within your trust model, if you're okay using Cash App, it's a potential that they could serve as a second layer solution, and you don't even know you're using Bitcoin.
You had Jack Dorsey on your show.
Yeah, Jack, friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. What is your take on where he thinks this stuff is going? Does he see the same stuff in the Cash App? Because I certainly see it. I'm actually exclusively using the Cash App to buy Bitcoin at this point.
Me as well.
And even though the rates are kind of bad sometimes, but...
Yeah, they do... Their rate's based on the spread, so they don't get you on fees. You don't have to pay a transaction fee.
You pay about $50 extra on the Coinbase price, but you don't pay a fee.
Yeah.
It's, $50 per Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Which isn't much. That's 1% at 5,000 or something, which is, I think, lower than Coinbase fees are.
Yeah, I think they put out a paper that sort of describes why they chose this instead of straight fees, and they think it's like cost savings in the long run.
Well, for me, when I started using Cash App, I feel like the next evolution was going to be like right now I sort of tilt how much money I have. Like, oh, I got like a little extra money. I'll buy 10, $20 worth of Bitcoin, right? That's where I'm at with Bitcoin now because I bought too much. I bought too much high and I'm like underwater now. I can't buy a lot more, but I do think at least when it was $4,000-ish, I was like, this is clearly the time to be buying Bitcoin, not investment advice. but really what I'd like to do is just take a portfolio of all the money I have and say, just keep 10% in Bitcoin all the time. Don't make me decide when to buy Bitcoin and when not to buy Bitcoin. Just keep leveling off my pool, you know?
Yeah, I think they're on their product roadmap. So they've got their Boost program, which helps you save money if you use their card at certain merchants. And I believe they're hacking. At least I saw their product lead on Twitter. I don't know if he was teasing this, but it seems that every week, if you use your Boost card at merchants that you get sort of cash back deals from, at the end of the week, they'll sum up the cash that you saved and buy a little Bitcoin for you sort of automatically. And then they also have to add automatic buys and stuff like that. So I believe that stuff's coming. And then going back to where Jack thinks this is, I think I only had a half an hour to sit down with him, but I think in that 30 minutes, he was hinting a lot. I think he was hinting a lot.
He seems excited about it.
Yeah, very excited. And I think lessons learned from Twitter are sort of helping him realize the potential here. I don't know. Maybe I was reading too far between the lines, but it seemed like he's very nostalgic of early Twitter days. And he said it felt more like a protocol like Bitcoin back then, where it was more open and we didn't really have control of it. And he said one thing where he'd like to separate the hosting from the serving of the content, which I thought was him hinting that maybe all this pressure of handling the best communication tool that humanity's ever seen is a lot for one company.
I think they're in a no-win situation. That doesn't let them off the hook, but yeah. There's an alternate future in which the early days of Twitter did feel like a protocol. They didn't have an app. When I signed up for Twitter, there was no Twitter app. And, mm-hmm. It was, a bunch of guys got Twitter, Twitter clients, go to town. Someone made a bot, go to town. It operated mostly like a protocol. If they had just, gone the Ethereum route and had, the nonprofit association for the furthering of Twittering.
Like a Mozilla route or something
Yeah, and I think, Twitter exists in 10 years from now, right? People ask this question about Bitcoin. Would you buy Bitcoin knowing that you had to hold it for 10 years? For me, the answer is yes. Would you predict Twitter exists in 10 years? Right now, I would say no. I'm not going to buy that ticket, I think.
I don't know.
But if you told me that Twitter was a protocol and people, of course it'll exist in 10 years. The same way that I expect email will exist in 10 years.
Right.
You know?
I don't know. I think there's a little cypherpunk in Jack. I think I could see it in his eyes when we were speaking. And with Bitcoin, what I was most taken aback by during our conversation, that was the one question I raised was Twitter has obviously been a communication tool that has sort of brought the fight to the state and politicians in particular. I'm going to just say it, fuck it. So we saw Twitter sort of affect politics, like Trump.
Trump is a product of Twitter.
Trump is a product of Twitter. Syria, like in 2012, I think I mentioned to him when John Kerry and them were thinking about bombing Syria. I truly believe that people pushing back on Twitter, like, oh, we shouldn't do this, actually had an effect on their decision. So like he's been around this tool, which has really changed the, sort of the leverage that individuals have against the state and curbing the state's tendency for violence. Bitcoin takes that to another order of magnitude. And so I framed it that way, like seeing this Twitter revolution and being a part of it, like, what do you see in common with what's happening with Bitcoin? And do you realize that this is order two of magnitude more heavy than a communications protocol now that we're making a money protocol?
Yeah.
And he sort of is just like, yeah, like it just makes sense that the internet will have a native digital currency. I think it most likely at this point will be Bitcoin. And he was just like, I hope the nation states help people out, like sort of submitting itself to the inevitability of a tool like this coming into reality. And then I think it excites him. And going, shifting from Twitter to Square, like Square's main mission is just enabling merchants and people to get access to money and financial services and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of the original Satoshi vision, in that I'm a longstanding believer that Satoshi was inspired by a PayPal transaction gone wrong. In Jay's estimation, if Satoshi is Dora Nakamoto, probably a toy train transaction gone wrong. But, you know, same problem, right? Square is still trying to solve some of the same problems as PayPal, as Bitcoin, as all of these things. Like, everyone's circling around the same corpse.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree with you that, like, Twitter has diminished the capacity for violence out there. Like, I think you can read most of this history both directions. Like, the fact that Trump is president, at least for me, as a increase in the capacity for violence, like at least like if we're just acting as like actuaries here, the potential. But I take your point, and I almost would extend it one step further, which is to say email is used for terror planning, fundraising, everything bad about Twitter exists in email. We just don't. Like, we're just like, well, there's nothing we can do about that. We can't stop Nazis from using email, so it's not an issue, you know? It's when you move away from being a protocol and become a platform that it becomes an issue. And I'm just like, anytime someone wants to start a platform, I'm like, don't start a platform. This world does not need more platforms. It might need more protocols, but it doesn't need more platforms.
Well, yes, and thank you for correcting me there. Like, the framing of that was off, like, Twitter.
It can be both at once.
It could be both ways, but it has affected politics and the way we interact with it. And Bitcoin is about to take that to a whole nother level. And that's another theory of the big, again, talking about like many paths we can go down. If we believe the sovereign individual path, it is that like things are going to get a little hectic, in that we were born at an inflection point, and like the first 100 years after that inflection point, which this book argues was in the 1970s when the internet was created, there's a lot of tumult and chaos, which I think we're experiencing in this world today.
People have always felt that way, but yes.
But the pace at which it's speeding up. Well, tying it back to Jack, I think he has learned a lot of lessons from Twitter, and Bitcoin is sort of like a fresh slate to build tools, having learned the lessons from Twitter.
Yeah,
and I think he is dead set on applying those lessons, and up to this point, he's been pretty badass. Like, it's good to see him come out and be principled about Bitcoin, so principled that he's about to support 6 devs, I believe, that are just working on the open source protocol. So that's stuff I want to see. Again, I think there's a little cypherpunk in him, and he's slowly but surely working it into his products.
All right, are we allowed to discuss price just a little bit?
Yeah, we can discuss price.
So price-wise, good week.
Great week.
I know that price is sort of a dirty word, though it makes sense to me why people are obsessed with it. And I think maybe zooming out a little bit, right? Not saying, hey, Bitcoin went from 4,400 to 5,200, which is fucking great. Like, how much should Bitcoin be worth? I get in this argument with Jay all the time, and I'm eager for another person to answer this question. I'll be like, Bitcoin does blah, 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 and that's why the price is going up. And he's like, it does all those things at Bitcoin 1,000, Bitcoin 10,000, and Bitcoin 100,000. So in some ways, you could say those things are almost tangential to price, because if you're in Venezuela and you're converting your life savings to Bitcoin, trying to get out of Venezuela and then pick them up somewhere else, the price of Bitcoin is just the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And so are we talking how much a Bitcoin be worth right now, or potentially if it's successful?
How should we even think about how much it should be worth? Like, what does your brain do when you try to answer that question?
Well, it's the famous buzzword in crypto, the total addressable market.
Right.
And what is that? And again, if this is truly like a zero-sum power laws game where Bitcoin presents, and this is an ideal situation, presents a perfect store of value, and you have cryptographic proof that you own a certain point in the ledger, if it's a better product from a store of value perspective. So right now, like, US dollars reserve currency of the world. And that's another reason why I'm really into Bitcoin, is because I don't think people have a tool through which to store their value over time. We have a time in which 40% of Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency expense. If you want to save your purchasing power or your wealth over time, your store of value vehicles, usually mutual funds, treasuries, things that are very volatile, and you're sort of forced to chase yield. If Bitcoin presents a perfect product for storing value, then you can sort of extrapolate that, okay, if this is the best store of value on the market and people are currently sort of stashing their value in different stores of value, and now this perfect store of value exists, you can start to assume that it'll take eat at some of those other store of values. So you talk about fine art, precious metals, real estate, land. If you're able to, some people believe, I'm not sure I fully believe this, but some people do believe that it could take over that store of value use case in those markets, and we're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars if that's the case.
I think I agree. I that's the viewpoint I take. Like, and then it's just like, all right, well, just, you know, peg it to like some kind of gold, old masters, like, how much is all that stuff worth? And that's basically saying how much money wants to flow into Bitcoin. And it's like, how much money wants to flow into Bitcoin? Okay, divide that by 21 million, but actually it's more like 14 million, but we might have lost some more coins. I'm not really sure, right? Okay, it's like, I can see that, like, back of the envelope. When I, like, got into doing shit on the internet, I came of age during the, 2010 to 2012 startup boom, where no one tried to make any money or do anything of any value. Maybe it's, like, altcoins is the parallel. And everyone chased users. Everyone chased growth, user growth. So part of me also is still, like, stuck in that mindset where I'm like, well, what will really make me think that Bitcoin is worth more is more people using Bitcoin, not addressable market. Like, when you look at, like, gold and fine art, it's like huge addressable market. We're actually only talking about like 100,000 people in the globe, right? And that would never fly for a Twitter type product that relies, in some ways, drives its value out of the network it itself has created of hundreds of millions of people. So on that rubric, that's the rubric I'm a little less bullish on Bitcoin on. And I've been a little bit like, that's what 2018 has shooken. I'm not shaken in the, like, it's a great, like, store of value, like, people are going to want to put millions of dollars into it. The user experience-based human thought virus of Bitcoin feels like it's lost a little steam over the last year. Are you, like, how, where are you on that? Like, where are you on, like, new users coming into Bitcoin? And does that even matter to how much Bitcoin is worth?
I don't think it matters, but I do think there's more interest. Like, and again, it comes in waves. It's like each cycle, each boom and bust in Bitcoin sort of brings more people, like a higher high watermark. And I do believe there's more interest right now than there ever has been. Obviously not like December 2017 levels right now, but I do think, and this is like an example just from my personal life, like, I used to work at Barstool Sports. I was known as Bitcoin Marty there, and I was crypto shaman during that mania, trying to tell everybody not to buy anything but nobody listened to me. And one of the personalities of Barstool in particular, Caleb Presley, he stuck with it. And he's like one example of somebody that I think of, somebody who got burned during the last cycle, but stuck with it and learned. And we actually, my Barstool indicator went off 2 months ago when two of my ex-coworkers sort of texted me like, yeah, let's meet up and talk about Bitcoin. So that was like the first thing. And yeah. Then as soon as the price went up last week, like they were talking about it on Barstool Radio. So just using Barstool as a barometer, like I think this time around, especially after 2017 when the mania got out of hand, there was a sort of like a level of understanding that those people, even if they got burned, have, and it's easier for them to sort of reemerge and learn more. It seems that people, even though they got burned, are still interested.
Yeah, there's like a weird, like I remember like Haruki Murakami said something about like, it's okay if only like 20% of people like my books who read them, because if like one out of every five people who reads any of my books becomes like a lifelong reader, I'm like snowballing like lots of readers, you know, like you don't necessarily have to convert everyone. It's okay if a lot of people come to the party once and leave. If you pick up some true believers along the way, well, like you've won in the long run.
Yeah, and this goes back to the concept of the intolerant minority. That's like, so Nassim Taleb made this concept popular, is that the intolerant minority runs the world. So things like having a lot of food labeled in the country kosher. There's probably like, a few hundred thousand?
Jews in America? 5 million.
5 million.
So one out of every 60-something people. But yeah. Kosher Jews?
Yeah.
Talking hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, a few hundred thousands, but yeah. they are an intolerant minority. It's sort of demanding that these, and this is the example that Nassim Taleb uses, that they demand that things be more kosher for them.
Sure, and I'd like to thank them for demanding that every Jewish holiday be a no street sweeping holiday in Brooklyn.
That's incredible.
It's a beautiful thing. I appreciate any intolerant minority who's gotten days added to the no street sweeping. We salute you.
Big fan of that. April 18th and 19th, I believe, this month are.
It's just a gift that keeps on giving. Like, if you subscribe to that no parking calendar, that indicator is just blowing up all the time.
Right.
Yeah. So in that example, is Bitcoin a intolerant minority?
Yes. So in many aspects, right? In many layers, like the intolerant minority, some would argue, sort of rule the way Bitcoin progresses to like the SegWit 2x, the fork wars of a couple of years ago, like people running, myself included, were like, no, it's probably advantageous that we do not arbitrarily raise the block size.
Yep.
And a minority of people running BIP 148, it's debatable how SegWit got added, but the sort of intolerant minority stops a change from happening in Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin and the whole macro level and where it fits into the world, like I do believe that's a possibility too, that a minority of people dead set on making fair money come into the world can make that happen. And again, Bitcoin is hard to kill. I've said it recently, like the only thing that could kill Bitcoin is a solar flare at this point. And to think that people are going to keep innovating, keep using this network is just, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm going to bring it full circle here so we can tie up. We started off with like, what kind of people is this attracting in forms of leadership, 12 men in the room. When I came upon those forks were like, that was right when I got like really into crypto, is right before that. So the first block size fork, I was like, holy shit. Like I couldn't go to sleep that night. I was like, what is going to happen? And when I sort of came to choose my personal allegiance, I did it basically based on the personalities of who was behind each side. Less like if you had flipped the two people, like the two factions onto opposite sides, I would have supported big blocks. Like if like a bunch of Bitcoin Cash assholes had been like, no block size change. And the other side had been, I would have been like, they're being reasonable. It really was kind of a referendum on like who the people behind it were.
Well, that, and again, this whole network and protocol development comes out to trade-offs, and yes, it's a type of personality. I agree. Like, I think the people in the Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV communities tend to be scammier, scummier, like con artist.
Former online fireworks salesman.
There's some pedos involved. Like, there's some weird people involved with those projects. And like, there's, probably shouldn't have said pedos, but fuck you, Rick Falconich.
Didn't say who you were talking about.
No, and then Bitcoin Core, obviously, like, it's just like more conservative, more people that I think more thoroughly about this and the trade-offs inherent in the system and understand the inherent trade-offs in the system. And not even personality, it's just understanding. So like, you have Roger Ver, who's not technical at all, has never written a line of protocol layer code, and trying to dictate how this protocol moves forward and how it scales. And then you have people on the Bitcoin Core team like Peter Willeb, Greg Maxwell, who are hardcore cryptographers that actually understand the math and the science that goes into making this protocol work. And who are you going? Again, it comes down to, at some extent, you have to sort of allocate your learning to somebody who else has a better understanding. And right. Bitcoin Core, it's like, it's obvious. Like, these developers who understand the code know more about the trade-offs than some opportunist who just bought a bunch in the beginning, completely misunderstood like the whole purpose of it, misunderstood the word cash in the white paper and what it means. Cash in the white paper refers to like the bare asset cash, not the cash that we're used to that's transaction or feeless when we transact and stuff like that. So yeah, there are different personalities, but I just think these people understand this stuff better.
I agree with that, although I think, to zoom out even further, I think to the outside world, all Bitcoiners, like all of crypto, is those scummy assholes. Like, if you create enough, like, this pool versus that pool, eventually you end up in a pool that's like a little less trustworthy. And I think for me, the next big frontier of Bitcoin is not going to be like internal schisms, like, I want a bigger block, I don't want a bigger block, but like, when does Bitcoin open up to a truly like larger community? And it'll be really interesting. Like, to me, I see an inherent contradiction between like some of the stuff you were talking about earlier on the program about like radical, like caliphate style economic change and true mainstream, I trust these people. Like, I don't know if those two things can coexist. And I remember who's the person who said that like eventually Bitcoin would become so mainstream that like its early libertarian proponents would be like disgusted by it. I can't remember who said that, but someone smart said that. I'm waiting for that moment. I'm waiting for the moment where Bitcoin, it has become so popular that it's difficult to reconcile with that kind of like economic change. And that'll be like, that's, if that, you know, first fork was like a minor skirmish, like that's the war I'm sort of waiting for.
That's the other thing people have to take into consideration, that like, this is the goal of Bitcoin, has become the money of the world, right?
And yep.
That's what people, obviously there is a development community and people that are very enamored with Bitcoin at this point in time that see themselves as a community. But as Bitcoin proliferates, becomes more mainstream, like, it's not a community, it's just people using a tool, like a tool that exists. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin. Going back to, it's apolitical. Like, it doesn't matter who uses it. Like, a socialist can use it, a hardcore libertarian can use it, somebody in Iran can use it, somebody in America could use it. And these people could have different views on the social layer of how they view the world. And that's the whole point of Bitcoin, is to make all these people that hate each other sort of be able to utilize this protocol that they can store their value in, even if they disagree.
All those people use email too.
Right? They all use email as well.
And HTML.
Yeah. And it's,
I feel like apolitical is like misleading, actually. Because apolitical suggests like not political, but it's almost like,
apolitical.
It's like all political.
Apolitical. I should say Bitcoin's amoral. It's apolitical in the sense that the protocol literally does not know how people are using it. It's just a messaging protocol that it's sending messages, and we know what's going on with it on top of it. Bitcoin, the protocol, is just producing blocks and doesn't know how we're using it. So it doesn't know that somebody from Iran is trying to use it, so it's not able to block. It's apolitical, right, in that sense.
Well, yeah. Someone would say that it's inherently, say, anti-authoritarian.
Oh, yes.
Because it's a tool that moves, like, it's like, hey, it's like apolitical, except these political beliefs. It's against those ones.
the application of Bitcoin is very political. The underlying protocol is amoral, apolitical, has no idea.
Okay, the last person I asked this question on the show was horrified, and he also runs a Bitcoin newsletter. But I'm going to try again because you seemed game when I brought up price. Mm-hmm. January 1st, 2020, Bitcoin price prediction?
We're within a $500 range of $10,000.
Ooh.
10,595.
It's funny how people are like, these artificial numbers mean nothing, though are deeply, deeply embedded in my mind. It's like, everyone in Bitcoin is like, arbitrary amounts like in US dollars mean nothing to me, but 10,000.
No, I just,
I'm the same way. Yeah. That's probably my, that's probably what I'm going to predict also.
It just feels.
Is about double from here. It feels about right.
Yeah, it feels like late 2015, early 2016 is where things were starting to turn. I think, I mean, again, I don't like to, this is just fun, like, whatever. Sure. I hope it's, I made a...
Not investment advice.
Not investment advice at all, but, like, I do think that the fundamentals, I mean, we saw it last week. Somebody bought Bitcoin in chunks of more than 1,000 Bitcoin, so more than $5 million at once, 10 times over the course of, like, 12 minutes over three exchanges last Monday. So somebody wanted to get Bitcoin and really push the price up. So, like, that was a flash in the pan of seeing, like, hey... Somebody who really wants to get in can move the price of this market 20% in a couple days.
Do you buy, I heard this theory and I'm curious your take on it. The theory was that that person bought those huge chunks and that there's way more algorithmic trading than there used to be. And it basically, those big buys triggered a bunch of robots to buy Bitcoin.
I don't know. They didn't trigger a bunch of robots. They triggered a bunch of shorts on like BitMEX. So that's what like the books at that price level were pretty thin, so they triggered, like, that's why we ran up so quickly, is because, like, the slippage that those buys caused sort of ran into these shorts and they got margin called, and but it wouldn't surprise me if it triggered some robo-traders as well.
This was great. Come back soon.
I definitely
will.
We
live close to each other.
I live right down the street.
We got a cave. We got plenty of weed in here.
No, I think I got more to say, too. I think...
I appreciate it. It was a great time. Where can people who would like to subscribe to your podcast and newsletter find you?
Podcast on Twitter is at TFTC21. Tales from the Crypt on most podcast platforms.
Yeah. Have you seen traffic starting to get a little hockey stick?
It is getting up.
Listenership?
Newsletter.
That was my indicator.
Subscriptions have been going up.
Yeah. My indicators are all going off right now.
Open rates are going up. If you want to subscribe to the newsletter, martysbent.com is where you can sign up. I'm actually working on a site to aggregate all the content, so it'll be in one spot soon. And then, yeah, I'm on Twitter at martybent, shitposting about Bitcoin. And yeah, the one thing I would like to end it on is like, this is all an experiment. It's something I'm passionate about. It could definitely fail in the long run, but I feel the urge to risk it for the biscuit with this. I do think we are at a very pivotal point in human history. And I do think Bitcoin presents an optimistic future, potential for an optimistic future. I know it's scary right now because it's Wild West. The fact that it's open source allows the shittiest people in the world. But Bitcoin has also introduced me to some of the best and like the purest people I've ever met in my life.
I mean, in 2040, when there's the oral history of Barstool, you're going to get referred to as Bitcoin Marty anyway. So you might as well stick with the ship.
It's true.
All right, come back soon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, April 10th at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $5,243.
That was Coin Talk. Thanks to our editor, James Nicholson. Thanks to my co-host, Jay Kang. He's hard at work on something awesome, which we'll tell you about. Thanks to my guest, Marty Bent. Thanks to everyone over at Medium and our friends over at xdat.io. It's a Euro crypto exchange, so if you're listening to this and you're in Europe, it might be good for you. And of course, thanks to Medium. They help make this show possible every week. You can find all of our episodes at medium.com/cointalk, including transcripts. Great user mail recently, so keep it up. It's at hi@cointalk.show. See you next week.